The Silence of Sidonius by Ian Wood. Introduction. Students of late antiquity and of the early Middle Ages are faced with a limited amount of source material. Naturally, they attempt to combine the material into a coherent narrative. More often than not, they use each source or block of sources as a stepping stone and move from one block to the next. The Germans have used the word Trittsteine. But often in doing so, they do not stop to comment on what is not in the sources in front of them, even though the gaps in the evidence may themselves be significant. A good example of this is the use of the writings of the senator and, in his last years, Bishop of Clermont, Sidonius Apollinaris, to reconstruct the history of Gaul from 455 to 480. Sidonius's letters and poems provide us with the most substantial body of evidence for central and southern Gaul in the third quarter of the 5th century. Yet for anyone trying to write a history of the period, there are substantial gaps in the information they convey, although they have rarely been fully acknowledged. The bishop's epitaph, however, allows us to identify some issues that are not covered in his surviving writings. In the light of the information provided by the epitaph, it is clear that Sidonius deliberately excluded information on certain periods and part of his life from his letter collection. It is worth considering why they were omitted when he himself collected his letters together. What follows is an identification of some of the bishop's silences and the reasons for them. To what extent have those silences skewed the general interpretation of late Gallo-Roman history that has been derived from the writings of Sidonius? And what adjustment should be made to the current reading of the period in the light of a recognition of the gaps in the record? Sidonius' epitaph and the reconstruction of his career. The standard image of Sidonius has been meticulously reconstructed from his correspondence. The result is a commonly accepted picture, his early career as an active member of the Gallo-Roman aristocracy, which included his delivery of panegyrics of emperors, including his father-in-law Avitus in 456 and Majorian in 458-9, the second of which is in many ways an apologia for the stance taken by the city of Lyon following the downfall of Avitus. His subsequent semi-retirement in what has been described as a phase of otium. His late career, beginning with his panegyric on the emperor Anthemius in 468 and culminating in his appointment as praefectus urbis Romae, one of the most distinguished offices of the empire. His elevation to the bishopric of Clermont following his return to Gaul from Italy, and his role in the defence of his episcopal city in the period of Gothic expansion, his exile to Liviana in the neighbourhood of Toulouse after the transfer of Clermont to the Visigoths in 475, and finally his return to his diocesan city and death, which should apparently be dated to 479. Certainly there are numerous points of detail that remain debatable, but the basic outline of Sidonius's life is agreed, as to a large extent, is its significance for the understanding of the implosion of Roman Gaul and the failure of the empire in the West. The effect of this reading of Sidonius is to present a history of Gaul in which the third quarter of the 5th century, between the deaths of Majorian and that of Sidonius himself, is seen primarily in terms of Visigothic history, culminating in Euric's takeover of much of Provence, although one should note the modification of this reading offered by Christine de Laplace, which presents a very much more sympathetic reading of the action of the Visigoths. The agreed reading of Sidonius's career, however, is challenged by his epitaph, which can no longer be ignored, as it has been by the majority of scholars, despite the fact that the text was published by Christian Leutjohann in his edition of the works of Sidonius. to relatively recent discoveries have meant that attention has to be paid to the bishop's funerary inscription. First, fragments of the inscription itself have been found and published, and second, a new manuscript copy of the text has provided the date for Sidonius's death, 479, which has important implications for interpreting the final years of his life. Activity that used to be dated to the early 480s has now to be squeezed into the years 478 and 9. Moreover, the inscription makes it fairly clear that we are dealing with an epitaph composed and carved in the late 5th or early 6th century, and we might guess that it was commissioned by Sidonius's son Apollinaris, not least because of Sidonius's own concern with the proper burial of his grandfather and with his provision of an epitaph for what had previously been an unmarked tomb. With such a precedent vividly recorded in his father's letter collection, Apollinaris may well have felt compelled to supply a memorial. That he revered his father's memory is clear from the letters of his cousin, Avitus of Vienne. The epitaph, as preserved in the most recently discovered manuscript witness, is as follows. Sanctis contiguus sanct croque patri, vivit sic meritis Apollinaris, illustris titulis potens honore, rector mili quiae forique iudex, mundi inter tumidas qui etus undas, causa rum moderan subinde motus, leges barbari code dit furori. Discordantibus inter arma regnis, pacem conciliore duxit amplo. Ec inter tamenet facundus ore, libris excoluit vitam parentis, et postalia dona gratiarum, summi pontificis sedens cathedram, munda nos sobali refudit actus. Quisque ic cum lacrimis teum rogabis, dextrum funde preces super sepulcrum, null incognitus et legendus orbi, illic Sidonius tibin vocetur. Duodecimo calendas, septembris Zenone consule. Translation. Close to the saints and to the Holy Father, thus Apollinaris lives by his merits, noble in title, powerful in honour, governor of troops and judge of the forum, calm among the surging waves of the world, moderator of lawsuits, and repeatedly moved. He gave laws to barbaric fury. To conflicted kingdoms in arms, he offered peace with full counsel. But among this, eloquent in speech, he honored the life of his parent in books, and after such gifts of thanks, sitting in the throne of the supreme bishop, he restored worldly acts to his child. Whoever of you will beg a god here with tears, pour out prayers here on the fortunate tomb, unknown to none and worthy of attention in the world. Then may Sidonius be invoked by you. Other manuscript witnesses offer Leges Barbaros, dedit furori, as an alternative reading for Leges Barbarico, dedit furori, in line 7, while also providing a radically different version of lines 10 and 11, aic inter tamen et philosophando, scripsit perpetuis abenda seclis. Among such things and philosophically, he wrote things to be preserved for all centuries. And they describe Zeno as emperor rather than consul. The epitaph opens with a reference to the dead man's chief secular honour in the service of the empire. Rector militiae forique iudex presumably alludes to Sidonius's urban prefecture, even though the reference is oddly elusive given the dignity of the office. There is a clear echo of the epitaph that Sidonius provided for the tomb of his grandfather, where he refers to consultissimus utilissimusque ruris militiae fori cultor, most informed and most effective husbandman of rural matters, troops and the forum. But one can also note the lack of precision in the description of the younger man's offices in comparison with the explicit references to the praetorian prefecture of his grandfather, praefectus post praetoria recta Galliarum, in the memorial composed by Sidonius himself. The elusive nature of the reference perhaps tells us something about the declining significance of the urban prefecture in the imagination of the Gallic aristocracy after the end of imperial rule. Having dealt with his subject's secular career, the epitaph refers to his literary output in a pair of lines which differ radically in the surviving transcriptions. I leave aside the 10-11 lines in the newly discovered copy, which refer to books about the life of a parent, since it is hard to see how they could fit with any known work of Sidonius, although this of course may point to another lacuna in our evidence. The alternative reading is easier to accept. Aec inter tamen et philosophando scriptis perpetuis habenda saeclis. There is then a reference to the episcopate of Sidonius, summi pontificis sedens cathedram, before a final invocation and dating clause. More significant for my present concerns are four lines in the middle of the epitaph, which require careful consideration, not least because they appear to refer to activity which is not covered in any of Sidonius's letters or poems. What interests me are lines 6 to 9. Causa rum moderans subinde motus, leges barbaros dedit furori, or leges barbari co dedit furori, discordantibus inter arma regnis pacem concilio reduxit amplo. The variant in line 7 is of no great significance, since either reading tells us that Sidonius was involved in legislating for barbarians. This reference to Sidonius's own lawmaking for barbarians hardly fits with the standard reading of the letter to Syagrius, where Sidonius describes his correspondent as a Solon of the Burgundians, a comparison which is usually taken to be comic or ironic. If Sidonius himself also acted as a legislator for barbarians, then we have to take the comparison with Solon rather as a compliment. On other occasions, comparison with Solon in Sidonius's verse is unquestionably complimentary. That he paid some attention to the lawmaking of barbarian rulers is also clear from his comments on the Visigothic king Theodoric, qui dicat modo iuragetis sub iudice vestro, pellitus raum praeconem suscipit ospes. Who now gives laws to the gods under your judge? The skin-clad guest receives the hoarse herald. Lines, which seem to have been picked up by the author of the Vita Patrum Jurentium in his description of the Burgundian Magister Militum, de gibi cung Chilperic, non ecernis degenerat in felix, ius fasque confusum, ob tuis tuorumque crebre in innocentium persuasione peccatis, mutari muriceus pellito sub iudice fascis. Do you not see the degenerate and unhappy man, law and right confused, on account of your sins and the frequent exactions of your men against the innocent, and the purple-covered fasces handed over to a skin-clad judge? There is also a reference in Sidonius's letter to Euric's legislation. But when, in the standard interpretation of Sidonius's career, did he act as a lawgiver for barbarians? When, too, did he help establish a peace between discordant regna? On these issues, Sidonius himself is silent, even though the next generation thought them worthy of record. It is clear from the structure of the epitaph that all this activity took place before he became bishop. However, it is not easy to find a conflict between barbarians in the period between 455 and 468, unless we hypothesize some early aggression by Euric immediately after his seizure of power in 466. It is possible to envisage that Sidonius played some diplomatic role in the aftermath of the defeat of British general Riotamus by the Visigoths in circa 469, since Riotamus and his surviving forces seem to have been settled in Gibicong-controlled territory that might have been a standoff between Euric and Chilperic. The British general had been acting in support of Anthemius, and Sidonius was clearly close to imperial circle at the time of his visit to Italy and immediately after. His letter to Riotamus could antedate his elevation to the episcopate. It is even possible that the defeat of the British leader and the settlement of his followers in the territory controlled by the Gibicongs antedates Sidonius' departure for Italy. The chronology of the conflict is by no means certain. Another potential context for Sidonius' activity as a peacemaker might be a conflict circa 4712, when Christine de Laplace has envisaged Visigothic support for Anthemius. Although that would be difficult to square with the chronology of Sidonius' consecration, which remains opaque, but it's not likely to be long after 469. Perhaps one point that we can conclude from the comment on his peacemaking in the epitaph is that Sidonius' observation on the negotiations conducted between the bishops acting on behalf of Julius Nepos and the Visigothic king Euric in 475 would have been those of a man who had himself been involved in diplomatic negotiations. As for his activity as a legislator, if it is to be dated before Sidonius' election to the episcopate, as appears to be the case from the epitaph, we have to conclude that it was to the Gibicung Magistri Militum, or the Middle Rhone Valley, that he gave legal counsel. For chronological reasons, it would be difficult to argue that he was drawn into the body of men around Euric, who were responsible for the 5th century legislation of the Codex Euricianus, even though he was certainly aware of their work, because he only became a subject of the Visigothic king after he was elected bishop. The phraseology of the epitaph, with the Burgundians being dismissed as barbari or barbarus furor, might have been very attractive to a Visigothic audience. If Sidonius's involvement in lawmaking was associated with the government of the Gibicung Magistri Militum, we effectively have to place it before his journey to Italy to deliver the Anthemius Panegyric in 468 and his subsequent tenure of the urban prefecture in 4689, in other words, during his supposed period of otium. Certainly, there is not much time between his return to Gaul and his election as a bishop of Clermont in 469 or shortly thereafter. We can, therefore, be reasonably certain that his legal activity should be placed before his lengthy stay in Italy, even though it does not sit well with the normal picture of his period of otium. Retraits 2 years, in the word of André Loyang, or in Ralph Matheson's phrase, first period of retirement. This, of course, also has important implications for our understanding of early Gibicung legislation. Gundioch and Chilperic were acting as Roman officials. The first phases of Burgundian law-giving are quite simply Roman, and Sidonius would have been advising them as a Roman official, even if some of the legislation was directed towards Burgundian or other federates. The dating of Sidonius' legislative activity may have implications for our understanding of his Italian journey. I've argued elsewhere that we have to understand Sidonius' delivery of the Anthemius panegyric in the light of the current situation in Italy and Gaul. We are not simply dealing with the personal decision of a Gallo-Roman senator to travel to the imperial court. The choice of Sidonius as panegyrist and his subsequent appointment as praefectus urbis cannot have been made without some acquiescence on the part of the Burgundian magister militum per Gallias, Chilperic, all the more so because of the strong connections between the Gibicungs and the magister militum praesentalis Ricimer. The latter was the brother-in-law of Gundioc, Chilperic's brother and predecessor as magister militum per Gallias. And Gundioc's son, Gundobad, who would emerge as Ricimer's heir in 472, may already have been at the side of his uncle in Italy by 468. In fact, the panegyric has a disproportionate amount to say about the marriage of Anthemius' daughter to Ricimer. At times it comes close to being an epithalamium. It is a panegyric for the regime as a whole. This rather confirms the likelihood that behind Sidonius' voyage to Italy, his delivery of the Anthemius panegyric and even his appointment as praefectus urbis lay the political alignment of Anthemius, Ricimer, Chilperic and Gundobad. Moreover, if Sidonius had already been providing legislative guidance to the Gibicung Magistri Militum per Gallias before his departure for Italy, this would have been significant preparation for his role as praefectus urbis. However we resolve the problem of Sidonius's peacemaking, his activity as a lawgiver means that we have to modify the picture of his first period of retirement or otium. Jill Harris noted Sidonius's silence over his elevation to the episcopate and indeed carefully unravelled the elusive way in which he deals with other awkward events and problematic individuals, most notably Arvandus. But his failure to say anything about his own activity as a peacemaker and a lawgiver is surely far more significant. Recognition of this aspect of his career calls into question the notion of Sidonius's first retirement, and it also suggests that we should give more credit to the Roman administration of the Gibicung Magistri Militum. What is there to fill out the claims of the epitaph? Outside the letters, there is unfortunately nothing in the so-called Leges Burgundionum or in the Gallic chronicles that provide clear evidence of Sidonius' diplomatic and legal activity between 461 and 467. The Liber Constitutionum of the Gibicungs, as we have it, which is better known as the Lex Burgundionum, is derived from a legal collection made in 517, although it seems to have incorporated an earlier law book which was probably issued in circa 500 and which itself apparently contained earlier laws issued by Gundioc, Chilperic and Gundobad. If we excavate the various strata of the code, we might be able to point to legislation influenced by Sidonius. The same is likely to be true if we were to examine the other Burgundian law book, the Forma et Expositio Legum, which is more usually but incorrectly known as the Lex Romana Burgundionum, and which would seem to be a collection made circa 500. It is a compilation of laws from the Codex Theodosianus, as well as later novels, some of which have been edited to suit current circumstances. It is possible that some of the laws included in the collection had been identified by Sidonius and Syagrius as being of particular relevance to the situation in Gaul in the 460s. But while the laws do not more than allow us to speculate on the identification of Sidonius' contribution to Gibicung lawmaking, There are some references to connections with the Gibichungs in Sidonius' letters, which allow a little more certainty about his dealings with the Burgundian leadership. There is a reference to the relations of Hilperic with Bishop Patience of Lyon. The Magister Militum liked the bishop's feasts, while the general's wife liked the cleric's fasts. Sidonius's knowledge seemed to imply close contact with the household of the Magister Militum. More important, Sidonius was extremely concerned for the safety of his relatives Apollinaris and Thaumastus in 474, when they were regarded as favouring the new emperor Julius Nepos, whose elevation was rejected by Hilperic. Although we learn little of what happened, it would appear that Sidonius was able to intervene with the Magister Militum per Gallias to protect his uncles. Yet more intriguing is the letter which recounts the arrival of the barbarian prince Sigismer, who was to marry the daughter of the Magister Militum. Historians have tried to identify the origins of Sigismer without any success. A more fruitful line of approach might be to juxtapose the letter on Sigismer with that written by Sidonius to the courtier and poet Secundinus. André Loyon gave the two letters significantly different dates, for no reason. It is clear from what Sidonius has to say that Secundinus had written court poetry and that he even covered a significant marriage. I would suggest that Secundinus delivered official verses on, among other subjects, the marriage of Sigismer. Certainly the letter must raise the likelihood that the court of the Gibichungs was a venue for poetry as much as was that of Uric. That being the case, we need to ask whether Sidonius himself delivered poems for Gundioch and Hilperic. The answer is surely yes, despite the absence of any surviving verse. Certainly Sidonius was composing poems throughout his life, as is apparent from the verses included in his letters. One might guess that the description of Hilperic and his wife as a new Lucumon and Tanaquil had its origins in some complimentary verse. However, the one poem dealing at length with the Burgundians that does survive in the author's oeuvre is his famous satire addressed to the Vir Clarissimus Catulinus, where the barbarians are depicted as uncouth, noisy and smelly. Sidonius was not alone in writing satirical verse. He encouraged Secundinus to continue writing satire against the Tyrannopolitae, though whether the tyrants have been correctly identified as the Burgundian rulers, as for instance by Loyang, is questionable. The only other known use of the word Tyrannopolita comes in the near-contemporary law of Glycerius, where it is directed against bishops. There were plenty of powerful people, other than the Gibichungs, who were misusing their authority. We meet one in the Vita Patrum Urensium, who is actually reprimanded by Hilperic. Why did Sidonius not include in his letter collection correspondence relating to his peacemaking and his legal activities? And why did he hide his close links with the Gibichung Magister Militum? A possible answer might be that they were actually not very important. One might argue that the major Roman official in Gaul was the Praetorian Prefect, who was usually resident in Arles, and Sidonius certainly did have significant connections with most of them, including Tonantius Ferreolus, Priscus Valerianus, Paeonius, Magnus Arwandus and Magnus Felix. The fate of Arwandus, accused of treason, was something that concerned him in particular. It is true that Gundioch and Hilperic made few appearances as Roman officials in any of our sources. For Gundioch as Magister Militum, we are dependent on a single letter contained in the Epistolae Arelatenses Genuinae, where we discover that in informing Pope Hilary about the matter, he played a role in dealing with the problematic episcopal election of Marcellus of Die. For Kilperic as a Magister Militum, we have a few references in Sidonius' own correspondence with regard both to his relation with Patiens of Lyon, and to his reaction to the elevation of Julius Nepos as emperor in Italy. In the Vita Patrum Jurensium, we see him as an active judge, and not surprisingly, as an official involved in the settlement of barbarians. Moreover, since the law of Gundobad makes it clear that more than one of his predecessors was a legislator, we can be certain that both Gundioch and Hilperic issued law. Although their lawmaking has to be excavated from the surviving Liber Constitutionum and Forma et Expositio Legum, we have to understand that as magistri militum, they were also issuing law for the wider population and not just for their barbarians' followers. But we can also be certain that both men were active as military leaders. We see them on campaign in 455-6, and it is therefore likely that they were involved in protecting their area of jurisdiction from outside threats. They were surely ultimately responsible for the defence of Clermont, even if in Sidonius's account the military hero was his own brother-in-law, Echidicius. We should also note that the Sidonius comments on Echidicius' close relations with kings, regum familiaritati. In other words, both Gundioch and Hilperic were figures of significance. Sidonius's failure to say much about them calls for some explanation, not least because for a good deal of time he and they were to be found in the same city, Lyon. The intended audience of Sidonius' correspondence and the Visigothic court. Here we need to consider the audience of his letter collection. The first seven books are addressed to Constantius, who is often described as a priest of Lyon. It does seem that he was buried in Lyon, if he is rightly associated with an epitaph that survives in the church of Saint Irenaeus, although it is by no means clear that he was a priest. Sidonius notes that he was a poet. He was also the author of the Life of Germanus of Auxerre. From Sidonius we learn that he was active in the territory of the Gibichung Magister Militum at the time of Euric's siege of Clermont. The eighth book of Sidonius's letters is dedicated to Petronius, although the final letter of the book is again addressed to Constantius, and the ninth to Firminus. The dedication to Constantius at first sight suggests a Lyon audience for the letter collection, and certainly Sidonius did have such an audience in mind, even if it was only secondary. Petronius and Firminus, however, suggest an audience in Visigothic territory since they are both associated with the city of Arles. An audience within Euric's kingdoms may also be implied by the dating of the collection. Sidonius would seem to have put together the first seven books while in exile at Liviana between 475 and 477. Books 8 and 9 were put together soon after, perhaps while Sidonius was still in exile, or otherwise immediately after his return to his episcopal city of Clermont. Since his epitaph probably provides us with a death date of 479, taking Furbetta's insistence that it is dated to the consulship of Zeno, all nine books of the collection must be placed in the 5 years from 475 to 479. In other words, despite the dedication to Constantius, Sidonius' immediate audience was to be found among the senatorial figures of the Visigothic kingdom and, by extension, among the leading men of the Visigothic court. Indeed, the Visigothic nature of the collection is immediately made clear in the second letter of Book I, the lengthy description of the court of Theodoric II. Effectively, the letter is given pride of place among all those gathered together. Jill Harris rightly stressed the significant placing of the letter within the collection, but without noting any connection with the context in which the collection made. The Visigothic court is also at the heart of other letters. Sidonius has sent Lampridius a verse description of Euric's court in a letter that surely belongs to his period of exile, and he supplied Evodius with a poem to accompany a gift for the Visigothic queen, Ragnhild, in a letter that has been dated to the late 460s. He also wrote to Leo of Narbonne, who would seem to have been one of Euric's closest Gallo-Roman advisers. There are no equivalent letters or poems dealing with the Gibichung court, even though Sidonius clearly had close connection with Gundobad and Chilperic for far longer than with Euric. Indeed, there are strikingly few letters that can be firmly dated to the 460s. Yet, in all probability, Sidonius' association with the Gibichungs went back to the attempt by the city of Lyon to challenge the rule of Majorian following the overthrow of Avitus, who was, of course, Sidonius' father-in-law. We do not know who was in charge of the Burgundian forces within the city when it held out against Majorian, but we may guess it was either Gundioch or Chilperic. Exactly what role was played by Sidonius himself in the episode is unclear, but the panegyric to Majorian implies that he had been deeply implicated in the city's opposition to the new emperor. Effectively, he was faced with having to offer excuses for the city's actions. As we have seen, despite his near silence on the matter, he surely had dealings with both Gundioch and Chilperic when they held the office of Magister Militum per Gallias, and were frequently resident in Lyon, which was indeed where Sidonius himself was usually to be found before 468. And as a bishop of Clermont, he certainly continued to have dealings with them up to the moment that his episcopal city was handed over to Euric. Despite all this, the Gibichungs and the Gibichung court are almost entirely missing from Sidonius's letters and poems, especially in comparison with what he has to say about the courts of Majorian, Theodoric II, and Euric. In the light of the evidence of the epitaph, this is surely deliberate. Sidonius has excluded material that would point to his association with Gundioch and Chilperic, and that is scarcely surprising, given that he was compiling the first seven books while under house arrests in territory whose ruler was at war with the Gibichungs. But this means that we cannot take the silence of Sidonius with regard to his life at the very end of the 450s and the early 460s as evidence for a period of retirement or otium. Absence of information is likely to reflect Sidonius' wish to edit the record, so as to imply non-involvement in contemporary affairs rather than to reflect a genuine period of retirement from politics. In the language of André Loyan, he was not a résistant, but a collaborateur, although, of course, the phraseology reflects attitudes from the period following the 1939-1945 war and is, in truth, not helpful for an understanding of the 5th century. What does this imply for a reconstruction of the history of Gaul in the third quarter of the 5th century? Most obviously, we have to be aware that Sidonius may have been a regular advisor to the Gibichungs from the fall of Majorian onwards. He was unquestionably involved in the early lawmaking. His involvement in the initial opposition of Lyon to Majorian would have endeared him to Gundioch and Chilperic, and perhaps also to Ricimer. This involvement must surely provide some of the background to the Anthemius panegyric. More generally, we should allow that the Gibichung Magistri Militum of the Rhone Valley had a more important role to play than is actually acknowledged. The standard reading is, of course, a reflection of the infrequency with which Gundioch and Chilperic appear in Sidonius' writings. Indeed, only one letter allows us to identify the office held by Chilperic, while for Gundioch Ox tenure of the magistracy, we are dependent on the Epistulae Arelatenses Genuinae. Conclusions. Sidonius's silence has almost invariably had an impact on modern readings of the period. Exactly how did the authority of the Gibichung Magistri Militum relate to that of the Praetorian Prefects of Gaul? Was the distinction one of spheres or action? Or did they have different geographical spheres of influence with the prefects based in Arles and master of the soldiers in Lyon? Was the Magister Militum based in Lyon because the city was closer to possible threats from the north than was Arles? It is moreover clear that the authority of Gundioch and Chilperic was not limited to the military power. Gundioch was active in reporting a disputed episcopal election, while Chilperic dealt with legal complaints as well as the political fallout from the arrival of Julius Nepos. One praetorian prefect, Arwandus, features prominently in several of Sidonius's letters because he was accused of colluding with Euric. The episodes of Arwandus and Ceronatus need to be considered in the light of the positions of the Gibichungs. Sidonius makes no reference to the Burgundian officials in the letters concerned with Arwandus and Ceronatus. But is it likely that they had no involvement in the political crisis surrounding the two men? And then there's the question of the association of the Gibichungs with Ricimer. Should we understand the Gibichungs primarily as Ricimer's agents in Gaul? They were related by marriage. They came to prominence more or less at the same times as Ricimer himself, although initially they belonged to different factions, Ricimer being involved in the overthrow of the Emperor Avitus, while the Gibichungs seem to have supported the followers of the deposed emperor. The appointment first of Gundioch and then of Chilperic as Magister Militum per Gallias must have been proposed by Ricimer not long after the marriage of his sister to Gundioch. And Gundioch's son Gundobad had emerged as Ricimer's political heir by 472. All this also provides the background for Sidonius's journey to Italy to deliver his panegyric in honour of Anthemius, and for his subsequent appointment as Praefectus Urbis. But this background has to be reconstructed without the aid of Sidonius. His silence must be deliberate, and it is reasonable to conclude that it reflects his desire to construct a Gallic history in which the old senatorial world passed directly into Visigothic control with no acknowledgement of the political realities of the years between 461 and 467 in which he himself had been involved. The skill with which he constructed his history has blinded historians to the significance of his silence, which can only be understood with reference to the context in which he collected his letters. Without his epitaph, we would have had no reason to question the image of his life and times, which he himself constructed in collecting his prose and verse, and which has become the staple for modern historians. At a more general level, we are back with the old conundrum that, quote, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, unquote. It is always important to attempt to identify silences, and once they have been identified, to ask what they might mean.